Side 7.
Chapter 13. Acme, Mud and Sulphur.
In the small red bus, there was only a negress with a withered arm, and beside the driver, a girl who kept her sick hands out of sight, and whose head was completely shrouded in a thick black veil which fell to her shoulders, like a beekeeper's hat, without touching the skin of her face. The bus, which said Acme, Mud and Sulphur Baths on its sides, and Every Hour on the Hour above the windscreen, went through the town without picking up any more customers, and turned off the main road down a badly maintained gravel track through a plantation of young firs. After half a mile, it rounded a corner and went down a short hill towards a cluster of dingy grey clapboard buildings. A tall yellow brick chimney stuck up out of the centre of the buildings, and from it a thin wisp of black smoke rose straight up into the still air. There was no sign of life in front of the baths, but as the bus pulled up on the weedy gravel patch near what seemed to be the entrance, two old men and a limping coloured woman emerged through the wire-screen doors at the top of the steps and waited for the passengers to alight. Outside the bus, the smell of sulphur hit Bond with sickening force. It was a horrible smell from somewhere down in the stomach of the world. Bond moved away from the entrance and sat down on a rough bench under a group of dead-looking firs. He sat there for a few minutes to steel himself for what was going to happen to him through the screen doors, and to shake off a sense of oppression and disgust. It was partly, he decided, the reaction of a healthy body to the contact with disease, and it was partly the tall, grim Belson chimney with its plume of innocent smoke. But most of all, it was the prospect of going in through those doors, buying the ticket, and then stripping his clean body and giving it over to the nameless things they did in this grisly, ramshackle establishment. The bus rattled off, and he was alone. It was absolutely quiet. Bond noticed that the two side windows and the entrance door made two eyes and a mouth. The place seemed to be looking at him, watching him, waiting for him. Would he come in? Would they have him? Bond moved impatiently inside his clothes. He got to his feet and walked straight across the gravel and up the wooden steps, and the frame doors banged to behind him. He found himself in a dingy reception room. The sulphur fumes were stronger. There was a reception desk behind an iron grill. Framed testimonials hung on the walls, some of them with red paper seals below the signature, and there was a glass-fronted showcase full of packages in transparent wrapping. Above it, a notice said, in badly handwritten capitals, "Take home an Acme pack. Treat yourself in privacy." There was a list of prices pasted onto a card advertising a cheap deodorant. The slogan still showed. It said, "Let your armpits be your charmpits." A faded woman with a screw of orange hair above a face like a sad cream puff raised her head slowly and looked at him through the bars, keeping one finger on her place in True Love Stories. "Can I help you?" It was the voice reserved for strangers, for people who didn't know the ropes. Bond looked through the bars with the cautious abhorrence she had expected. "I'd like a bath." "Mud or sulphur?" She reached for the tickets with her free hand. "Mud." "Would you care for a book of tickets? They're cheaper."
"Just one, please."
$1.50. She pushed through a mauve ticket and kept a finger on it until Bond had put his money down.
"Which way do I go?"
"Right," she said. "Follow the passage. Better leave your valuables." She slipped a large white envelope under the grill. "Write your name on it." She watched sideways as Bond put his watch and the contents of his pockets into the envelope and scribbled his name on it. The $20 bills were inside Bond's shirt. He wondered about them. He pushed the envelope back.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome." There was a low wicket at the back of the room and two white-painted wooden hands whose drooping index fingers pointed right and left. On one hand was written "Mud," and on the other, "Sulphur." Bond went through the wicket and turned to the right along a dank corridor with a cement floor which sloped downwards. He followed it and pushed through a swing door at the end and found himself in a long, high room with a skylight in the roof and cabins along the walls. It was hot and steamy and sulphurous in the room. Two youngish, soft-looking men, naked except for grey towels around their waists, were playing gin rummy at a deal table near the entrance. On the table were two ashtrays full of cigarette butts, and a kitchen plate piled with keys. The men looked up as Bond entered, and one of them picked up a key from the plate and held it out. Bond walked over and took it. 12, said the man. Got your ticket? Bond handed it over, and the man made a gesture towards the cabins behind him. He jerked his head towards a door at the end of the room. Bath through there. The two men went back to their game. There was nothing in the frowsy cabin but a folded towel, from which constant washing had removed all the nap. Bond undressed and tied the towel round his waist. He folded the bulky packet of notes and stuffed them into the breast pocket of his coat, under his handkerchief. He hoped it would be the last place that a petty thief would look in a quick search. He hung up his gun in the shoulder holster on a prominent hook and walked out and locked the door behind him. Bond had no idea what he would see through the door at the end of the room. His first reaction was that he had walked into a morgue. Before he could collect his impressions, a fat, bald negro with a downturned, straggling moustache came over and looked him up and down. "What's wrong with you, mister?" he asked indifferently. "Nothing," said Bond shortly. "Just want to try a mud bath." "Okay," said the negro. "Any heart trouble?" "No." "Okay, over here." Bond followed the negro across the slippery concrete floor to a wooden bench alongside a pair of dilapidated shower cubicles, in one of which a naked body hung with mud was being hosed down by a man with a cauliflower ear. "Be right with you," said the negro casually, his big feet slapping against the wet floor as he sauntered off about his business. Bond watched the huge, rubbery man, and his skin cringed at the thought of putting his body into the dangling, pudgy hands with their lined pink palms. Bond had a natural affection for coloured people, but he reflected how lucky England was compared with America, where you had to live with the colour problem from your school days up. He smiled as he remembered something that Felix Leiter had said to him on their last assignment together in America. Bond had referred to Mr. Big, the famous Harlem criminal, as "that damn nigger." Leiter had picked him up. "Careful now, James," he had said. "People are so damn sensitive about colour around here that you can't even ask a barman for a jigger of rum. You have to ask for a gigro." The memory of Leiter's wisecrack cheered Bond up. He took his eyes off the negro and looked over the rest of the Acme mud bath. It was a square, grey, concrete room. From the ceiling, four naked electric light bulbs, spotted with fly droppings, threw an ugly glare on the dripping walls and floor. Against the walls were trestle tables. Bond automatically counted them. 20. On each table was a heavy wooden coffin with a three-quarter lid. In most of the coffins, the profile of a sweating face showed above the wooden sides and pointed up at the ceiling. A few eyes were rolled inquisitively towards Bond, but most of the congested red faces looked asleep. One coffin stood open, its lid up against the wall and its side hinged down. This seemed to be the one destined for Bond. The negro was draping a heavy, unclean-looking sheet over it and smoothing it down to form a lining to the box. When he had finished, he went to the middle of the room and chose two from a line of pails, filled to the top with steaming, dark brown mud, and dropped them with a double clang beside the open box. Then he dug his huge hand into one of them and smeared the thick, viscous stuff along the bottom of the shroud, and went on doing this until the whole bottom of it was 2 inches thick with mud. He then left it, to cool, Bond supposed, and went to a dented hip bath full of ice blocks, and groped around and extracted several dripping hand towels. He put these over his arm and made a round of the occupied coffins, stopping every now and then to wrap a cool towel round the sweating forehead of one of the occupants. Nothing else was happening, and the room was quite silent, except for the hiss of the hose close to Bond. This stopped, and a voice said, "All right, Mr. Weiss, that should fix you for today." And a fat, naked man with a great deal of black body hair tottered weakly out of the shower cubicle and waited, while the man with the cauliflower ear helped him into a terry-cloth bathrobe, gave him a quick rub down inside it, and led him to the door through which Bond had come. Then the man with the cauliflower ear walked over to a door in the far corner of the room and went out. For a few moments, light streamed through the door, and Bond saw grass outside and a blessed glimpse of blue sky, and then the man came back with two more steaming buckets of mud. He kicked the door shut behind him and added to the line of buckets in the middle of the room. The negro went over to Bond's coffin and touched the mud with the flat of his hand. He turned and beckoned to Bond. "Okay, mister," he said. Bond walked over, and the man took his towel and hung his key on a hook above the box. Bond stood naked in front of him.
Ever had one of these before?
No.
Thought maybe not, so I'm giving you the mud at 110. If you're acclimated, you can take 120 or even 130. Lie down there.
Bond gingerly climbed into the box and lay down, his skin smarting at its first contact with the hot mud. He slowly stretched himself out full length and lowered his head onto the clean towel that had been placed over the kapok pillow. When he was settled, the Negro dug both hands into one of the buckets of fresh mud and proceeded to slap it all over Bond's body. The mud was a deep chocolate brown, and it felt smooth and heavy and slimy. A smell of hot peat came up to Bond's nostrils. He watched the slimy, blubbery arms of the Negro working over the obscene black mound that had once been his body. Had Felix Leiter known what this was going to be like? Bond grinned savagely at the ceiling. If this was one of Felix's jokes. At last the Negro had finished, and Bond was loaded with hot mud. Only his face and an area around his heart were still white. He felt stifled, and the sweat began to pour down his forehead. With a swift movement, the Negro bent down and picked up the edges of the sheet and wrapped them tightly around Bond's body and his arms. Then he reached up for the other half of the dirty shroud and bound this also round him. Bond could just move his fingers and his head, but otherwise he had less freedom of movement than in a straitjacket. Then the man closed the open side of the coffin, lowered the heavy wooden lid, and that was that. The Negro took a slate down from the wall above Bond's head and glanced at a clock high up on the far wall and scribbled the time down. It was just 6 o'clock.
20 minutes, he said. Feel good?
Bond gave a neutral grunt. The Negro moved away about his business, and Bond stared dumbly up at the ceiling. He felt the sweat running down from his hair into his eyes. He cursed Felix Leiter. At 6:03, the door opened to admit the naked, scrawny figure of Tingling Bell. He had a sharp, weaselly face and a miserable body on which each bone showed. He walked cockily into the middle of the room.
"Hi, Tingling," said the man with a cauliflower ear. "I heard you had some trouble today. Too bad."
"Damn stewards is a heap of obscenity," said Tingling sourly. "Why would I want to ride across Tommy Lucky, one of my best pals? And why would I need to? The race was sewn up. Hey, you black bastard!"
He put out his foot to trip up the Negro, who was passing with a pail of mud.
"You gotta get 6 ounces off me. Just have me a plate of French fries. On top of that, they're giving me a heap of lead to carry in the Oak Ridge tomorrow."
The Negro stepped over the outstretched foot and chuckled fatly.
"Don't worry, baby," he said affectionately. "I can always break your arm off. Get your weight down easy that way. Be right with you."
The door opened, and one of the card players put his head in.
"Hey, boxer," he said to the man with the cauliflower ear. "Mabel says she can't get on to the delicatessen to order your chow. Phone's busted. Lying down or something."
"Ah, Jesus," said the other. "Tell Jack to bring it on his next ride."
"Okay."
The door closed. A telephone breakdown in America is a rare thing, and this was the moment when a small danger signal might have shrilled in Bond's mind. But it didn't. Instead, he looked at the clock. Another 10 minutes in the mud. The Negro sauntered across with the cold towels over his arm and wrapped one round Bond's hair and forehead. It was a delicious relief, and Bond had a moment of thinking that perhaps the whole business was just supportable. The seconds ticked by. The jockey, with a crackle of obscenities, lowered himself into the box directly in front of Bond, and Bond guessed that he was being given the mud at 130°. He was wound up in the shroud, and the lid was banged shut over him. The Negro wrote 6:15 on the jockey's slate. Bond closed his eyes, and wondered how he was going to slip the man his money. In the restroom after the bath, there was presumably somewhere one went to lie down after all this, or in the passage on the way out, or in the bus. No, better not in the bus. Better not be seen with him.
"All right. Nobody move now. Just take it easy and no one will get hurt."
It was a hard, deadly voice that meant business. Bond's eyes snapped open and his body tingled at the reek of danger that had come into the room. The door to the outside, the door through which the mud came, was standing open. A man stood in the opening, and another man was advancing into the middle of the room. They both had guns in their hands. and they both had black hoods over their heads with holes cut for the eyes and mouth. There was silence in the room, except for the sound of water falling in the shower cubicles. Each cubicle contained a naked man. They peered out into the room through the veil of water, their mouths gulping for air and the hair streaming into their eyes. The man with the cauliflower ear was a motionless pillar. His eyes shifted whitely as the hose in his hand poured water over his feet. The moving man with the gun was now in the middle of the floor by the steaming pails of mud. He stopped in front of the Negro, who was standing with a full bucket in each hand. The Negro quivered slightly so that the handle on one of the buckets gave out a slight rattle. While the man with the gun held the Negro's eyes in his, Bond saw him turn the gun round in his hand so that he was holding it by the barrel. Suddenly, with a backhanded blow that had all his shoulder behind it, he lashed the butt of the revolver into the centre of the Negro's huge belly. There was only a sharp, wet slap from the blow, but the buckets crashed to the floor as the Negro's two hands leapt up and clutched at himself. He let out a soft moan and sagged forward onto his knees, his glistening, shaven head bowing down almost to the man's shoes so that he appeared to be worshipping him. The man drew back a foot. "Where's the jock?" he said menacingly. "Bell. Which box?" The Negro's right arm shot out. The man with the gun brought his foot down. He turned and walked across to where Bond was lying toe-to-head with Tingling Bell. He came up and looked first down at Bond's face. He seemed to stiffen. Two glittering eyes looked down through the diamond slits in the black hood. Then the man moved to the left and stood over the jockey. For a moment he stood motionless, then he took a quick jump and hoisted himself up so that he was sitting on the lid of Tingling's box, looking down into his eyes. "Well, well! Damn if it ain't Tingling Bell!" There was a ghastly friendliness in his voice. "What's the matter?" Jockey's voice was shrill and terrified. "Why, Tingling!" The man was reasonable. "What would be the matter? Got anything on your mind?" The jockey gulped. "Maybe you never heard of a horse called Shy Smile, Tingling. Maybe you weren't there when he was rode foul at around 2:30 this afternoon." The voice ended on a hard edge. The jockey started to cry softly. "Jesus, boss, that weren't my fault. Happened to anybody." It was the whimper of a child who was going to be punished. Bond winced. "My friends figure it may have been a double cross." The man was leaning close over the jockey and his voice was gaining heat. "My friends figure a jock like you could only done something like that intentional. My friends looked over your room and found the grand plugged away in the lamp socket. My friends wish me to inquire where that letter's come from." The sharp slap and the shrill cry were simultaneous. "Give you bastard or I'll blow your brains out." Bond heard the click of the hammer going back. A stammering scream came out of the box. "My wad! Oh, my God! Hit it away in the lamp! My wad, I swear it! Christ, you gotta believe me, you gotta!" The voice sobbed and implored. The man gave a disgusted grunt and lifted his gun so that it came into Bond's line of vision. A thumb with a big, angry wart on the first joint eased the hammer back. The man slipped down off the box. He looked into the jockey's face and his voice went slimy. "You've been riding too much lately, Tingling," he almost whispered. "You're in bad shape, need a rest, plenty quiet, like in a sanatorium or something." The man slowly moved back across the floor. He went on talking quietly and solicitously. Now he was out of the jockey's line of vision. Bond saw him reach down and pick up one of the steaming buckets of mud. The man came back, holding the bucket low, still talking, still reassuring. He came up to the jockey's box and looked down. Bond stiffened and felt the mud stir heavily on his skin. "Like I said, Tingling, plenty of quiet. Nothing to eat for a whiles. Nice shady room with the drapes drawn to keep out the light." The soft voice droned on in the dead silence. Slowly the arm came up, higher, higher. And then the jockey could see the bucket, and he knew what was going to happen, and he started moaning. "No! No, 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 no!" Although it was hot in the room, the black stuff steamed as it poured sluggishly out of the bucket. The man stepped swiftly aside and hurled the empty bucket at the man with the cauliflower ear, who stood still and let it hit him. Then he moved fast across the room to where the other man with the gun stood near the door. He turned. "No funny business. No cops. Phone's busted." He gave a harsh laugh. Better dig the guy out before his eyeballs fry. The door banged, and there was silence, except for a bubbling sound and the noise of the water gushing in the shower. Chapter 14. We don't like mistakes. Then what happened? Lyta was sitting in Bond's chair in the motel, and Bond was pacing up and down the room, stopping every now and then to take a drink from the glass of whiskey and water by the bed.
Bloody chaos, said Bond. Everybody yammering to be let out of his box, and the man with the cauliflower ear hosing the stuff off Tingling's face and shouting for help to the two men in the next room. The negro moaning on the floor, and the naked guys from the showers teetering about like chickens with their heads cut off. The two card-playing men came busting in, and they took the lid off Tingling's box and unwrapped him and carried him under the shower. I guess he was nearly gone, half suffocated, whole face puffed up with the burns. Ghastly sight. Then one of the naked men pulled himself together and went round opening the boxes and letting the people out, and then there we were, 20 men covered with mud and only one shower to spare. It gradually got sorted out. One of the help went off to drive into town for an ambulance. Somebody poured some water over the negro, and he gradually came to life. Without seeming too interested, I tried to find out if anyone had any idea who the two gunmen were. No one had a clue. It was thought they were from an out-of-town mob. Nobody cared now that no one had got hurt except the jockey. All they wanted to do was get the mud off themselves and get the hell out of there. Bond took another swallow of whiskey and lit a cigarette. Was there anything that struck you about these two guys? Asked Lyta. Height, clothes, anything else? I couldn't see much of the man by the door, said Bond. He was smaller than the other and thinner, wearing dark trousers and a grey shirt with no tie. Gun looked like a 45, might have been a Colt. The other man, the one who did the job, was a big, fattish guy, quick-moving but deliberate. Black trousers, brown shirt with white stripes, no coat or tie, black shoes, neat, expensive. 38 police positive, no wristwatch. Oh, yes, Bond suddenly remembered. He had a wart on the top joint of his right thumb. Red-looking, as if he had sucked it. Wint, said Lyta flatly, and the other guy was Kid. Always worked together. They're the top torpedoes for the Spangs. Wint is a mean bastard, real sadist, likes it. He's always sucking at that wart in his thumb. He's called Windy, not his face, that is. All these guys have crazy names. Wint can't bear to travel, gets sick in cars and trains, and thinks planes are death traps. Has to be paid a special bonus if there's a job that means moving around the country. But he's cool enough when his feet are on the ground. Kid's a pretty boy. His friends call him Boofy. Probably shacks up with Wint. Some of these homos make the worst killers. Kid's got white hair, although he's only 30. That's one of the reasons they like to work in hoods. But one day that fellow Wint is going to be sorry he didn't have that wart burned away. I thought of him as soon as he mentioned it. Guess I'll get along to the cops and tip them off. I won't mention you, of course, but I'll give them a lowdown on Shy Smile, and they can work it out for themselves. Wint and his friend will be taking a train in Albany by now, but no harm in getting some heat on. Lyta turned at the door. Take it easy, James. Be back in an hour, and we'll go and get ourselves a good dinner. I'll find out where they've taken Tingling, and we'll mail the dough in there. Might cheer him up a bit, poor little bastard. Be seeing you. Bond stripped and spent 10 minutes under the shower, lathering himself all over and washing his hair to get rid of the last filthy memory of the Acme baths. Then he dressed in trousers and shirt and went over to the telephone booth in the reception hall and put in a call to Shady Tree.
"The line is busy, sir,"
chanted the operator. "Will I keep the call
in?" "Yes, please," said Bond, relieved that the hunchback was still in his office and that now he would be able to say truthfully that he had tried to get through earlier. He had an impression that Shady might be wondering why he hadn't called up to complain about Shy Smile. After seeing what had happened to the jockey, Bond was more inclined to treat the spangled mob with respect. The telephone gave the dry, muted burr that serves for a ring on the American system.
"Were you wanting Wisconsin 73697?
"Yes."
"I have your party now, sir. Go ahead, New York."
And the thin, high voice of the hunchback.
"Yes? Who's calling?"
"James Bond. I tried to reach you earlier."
"Yes?"
Shy Smile didn't pay off.
"I know. The jockey bitched it. So what?"
"Money."
said Bond. There was silence at the other end. Then,
okay, we start again. I'll wire you a grand, the grand you want off of me, remember?
Yes.
Stand by the phone. I'll call you back in a few minutes and tell you what to do with it. Where are you staying?
Bond told him.
Okay, you'll get the money in the morning. Be calling you shortly.
The phone went dead. Bond walked over to the reception counter and glanced over the rack of paperbacks. He was amused and rather impressed by the meticulous accounting of these people and the care they took to have each step of their operations protected by a legitimate cover plan. They were right, of course. Where would he, an Englishman, be able to get $5,000 except by gambling? And what would the next gamble be? The telephone crooked a mechanical finger at him, and he went into the box and closed the door and picked up the receiver.
That's you, Bond. Now listen carefully. You've got to get it at Las Vegas. Come down to New York and pick up a plane. Charge the ticket to me. I'll okay it. Through service to Los Angeles, and there's a local plane every half hour to Vegas. You have a reservation at the Tiara. Find your way around, and now listen to this carefully. At just 10:05 on Thursday evening, go to the center of the 3 blackjack tables at the Tiara on the side of the room near the bar. Got that?
Yes.
Sit down and play the maximum. That's a grand. 5 times. Then get up and quit the table, and don't gamble anymore. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Your check is paid at the Tiara. After the game, hang around and wait for further instructions. Got that?
Repeat. Bond did so.
Check, said the hunchback. Don't talk, don't make a mistake. We don't like mistakes. You'll find that when you read tomorrow's paper.
There was a soft click. Bond put down the receiver and walked thoughtfully across the lawn to his room. Blackjack. The old 21 of childhood days. It brought back memories of big teas and other children's playrooms, of grown-ups counting out the coloured bone counters and piles so that each child had a shilling's worth, the excitement of turning up a 10 and an ace and being paid double, the thrill of that 5th card when one already had 17 and wanted a 4 or less for 5 and under. And now he was going to play the nursery game again. Only this time the dealer would be a crook, and the coloured counters of his bet would be worth £300 on each hand. He had grown up. And now this would be a real grown-up game. Bond lay down on his bed and stared at the ceiling. As he waited for Felix Leiter, his mind was already reaching ahead to the famous gambling town, wondering what it was going to be like, wondering how much he would be able to see of Tiffany Case. 5 cigarette ends had piled up in the plastic ashtray before he heard Leiter's limping step on the gravel path outside. They walked across the lawn together to the Studelac, and as they drove down the avenue, Leiter brought him up to date. The Spangled boys had all checked out. Pizarro, Bud, Wint, Kid. Even Shy Smile was already off on the first leg of his long journey by horse box right across the continent to the ranch in Nevada. The FBI are on the case now, said Leiter, but it will only be one short story in their collected works of Spang. Without you as a witness, nobody's going to have any idea who the 2 gunmen were. And I'd be surprised if the FBI got very worked up about Pizarro and his horse. They'll leave that to me and my outfit. I've talked to head office, and they've told me to get out to Vegas and somehow find out where the remains of the real Shy Smile are buried. I've got to lay my hands on his teeth. How'd you like that? Before Bond had time to comment, they had drawn up outside the Pavilion, the only smart restaurant in Saratoga. They got out and left the car to be parked by the doorman.
It's good that we can have a meal together again, said Leiter.
You've never eaten broiled Maine lobster with melted butter like they do it here, but it wouldn't taste so good if there was a chance that one of the Spang boys might be munching spaghetti with Caruso's sauce at the next table.
It was late, and most of the diners had finished their meal and gone off to the sales ring. They had a corner table to themselves, and Leiter told the head waiter not to hurry with the lobsters, but to bring 2 very dry martinis made with Cresta Blanca vermouth.
So you're going to Las Vegas, said Bond. Funny coincidence, department. He told Leiter about his conversation with Shady Tree.
Sure, said Leiter. No coincidence about it. We're both traveling bad roads, and all bad roads lead to the bad town. I've got some cleaning up to do here in Saratoga first, and a pile of reports to write. That's half my life with Pinkertons, writing reports. But I'll be over in Vegas before the end of the week, sniffing around.
Shan't be able to see much of you right under the spang nose, but maybe we could meet up from time to time to exchange notes. Tell you what, he added, we've got a good man there, undercover. Cab driver by the name of Correo, Ernie Correo. Good guy, and I'll pass the word you're coming, and he'll look after you. He knows all the dirt, where the big fixes are, who's in town from the outside mobs. He even knows where he can find the one-armed bandits that pay the best percentages. And the slots that pay best is the most valuable secret in the whole goddamn strip. Boy, you see nothing until you see that strip. 5 solid miles of gambling giants. Neon lighting that makes Broadway look like a kid's Christmas tree. Monte Carlo, Lighter snorted. Steam age stuff. Bond smiled. How many zeros have they got on the roulette? 2, I guess. There's your answer. At least we play against the right percentage in Europe. You can have your neon lighting. The other 0 keeps it alight. Maybe, but the craps only pay just over 1% to the house, and that's our national game. I know, said Bond. Baby needs a new pair of shoes, all that sort of kid's talk. I'd like to hear the banker for the Greek syndicate whining, baby needs a new pair of shoes, when he's already got 1-9 against him at the high table and there are 10 million francs on each tableau. Lighter laughed. Hell, he said, you've got it easy with this crooked playoff at the blackjack table. You'll be able to swank around back in London and tell the story of how you took him at the Tiara. Lighter took a pull at his whiskey and sat back in his chair. But I'd better give you some of the background to the games, just in case you get it into your mind to stake your pennies against their pot of gold. Go ahead. And I mean a pot of gold, continued Lighter. You see, James, the whole state of Nevada, which, so far as the public cares, consists of Reno and Las Vegas, is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The answer to the public dream of something for nothing is to be picked up for the price of your plane fare on the Strip at Las Vegas or on the main stem at Reno. And it really is there. And not so long ago, when the stars and the dice were right, a young GI made 28 straight passes at a crap table in the Desert Inn. 28. If he'd started with $1 and been allowed to let it ride over the house limits, which, knowing Mr. Wilbur Clark at the inn, I guess he might not have been, he would have made $250 million. Of course, he didn't let it ride. Side bettors made $150,000. The GI made $750 and took to his heels as if the devil was after him. They never even got his name. Today, that pair of red dice is on a satin pillow in a glass case in the Desert Inn Casino. Must have been good publicity. Bet your life, said Lighter. All the ad man in the world couldn't have dreamed it up. It made the wishing well dream come true, and you wait till you see them wishing in those casinos. In just one of them, they use up 80 pairs of dice every 24 hours, 120 packs of plastic cards, 50 slot machines go to the garage every day at dawn. And wait till you see the little old ladies in gloves working those slots. They have shopping baskets to carry the nickels and dimes and quarters. They work those slots 10-20 hours a day without going to the restroom. You don't believe me? You know why they wear gloves? To stop their hands bleeding. Bond grunted noncommittally. All right, agreed Lighter. Sure, these people collapse. Hysteria, heart attacks, apoplexy. The cherries and plums and bells climb through their eyes into their brains. But all the casinos have house physicians on 24-hour call, and the little old women just get carried out screaming, jackpot, 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 as if it was the name of a dead lover. And take a look at the bingo parlors and the wheels of fortune and the banks of slots downtown and the golden nugget and the horseshoe. But don't you go and get the fever and forget your job and your girl and even your kidneys. I happen to know the basic odds at all the games. And I know how you like to gamble, so do me a favor and get them into your thick head. Now, take them down. Bond was interested. He took out a pencil and tore a strip off the menu card. Lighter looked at the ceiling. 1.4% in favor of the House of Craps. 5% of blackjack, he looked down at Bond, except at your game, you crook. 5.5% at roulette, up to 17% at bingo and the Wheel of Fortune, and 15-20% at the slots. Not bad for the house, huh? Every year, 11 million customers play Mr. Spang and his friends at those odds. Take $200 as an average sucker's capital, and you can work out for yourself how much stays in Vegas over a year's play. Bond put the pencil and the piece of paper away in his pocket. Thanks for the documentation, Felix. But you seem to forget that I'm not going to this place for a holiday. Okay, damn you, said Lighter resignedly.
But don't you go fooling around in Vegas. It's a big operation they've got there, and they won't stand for any monkey tricks.
Lighter bent across the table. Let me tell you,
the other day there was one of these dealers, Blackjack, I think it was, decided to go into business for himself. Slipped a few bills in his pocket one evening during play. Well, they spotted him. Next day, some innocent guy's driving into town from Boulder City, and he spots something pink sticking up out of the desert. Couldn't be a cactus or anything, so he stops and has himself a look.
Lighter prodded Bond's chest with a finger. My friend, that pink thing sticking up was an arm. And the hand at the top of the arm was holding a full deck of cards fanned out. The cops came with spades and dug around, and there was the rest of the guy under the ground at the other end of the arm. That was the dealer. They'd blown the back of his head off and buried him. The fancy work with the arm and the cards was just to warn the others. Now, how'd you like that?
Not bad, said Bond. The dinner came, and they started to eat.
Mark, you, said Lighter between mouthfuls of broiled lobster, the dealer should have known better than get caught with his duke in the tambourine. They've got a good trick in these Vegas casinos. Take a look at the ceiling lights. Very modern. Just holes in the ceiling with light beamed through onto the tables. They throw a very strong light with no sideways glare to upset the customers. Take another look, and you'll see there's no light coming from the alternate holes. They just seem to be there to make a pattern.
Lighter slowly shook his head from side to side. Not so, my friend. Up on the floor above, there's a television camera on a dolly that moves around the floor, taking an occasional peek through those empty holes. Kind of a spot check on the play. If they're wondering about one of the dealers, or about one of the players, they'll take a picture of the whole of one session at that particular table, and every damn card or throw will be watched by the guys sitting quietly upstairs. Smart, hmm? These dumps are wired for everything except smell. But the dealers know it, and this guy just hoped the camera was looking somewhere else. Fatal error. Too bad.
Bond smiled at Lighter. I'll watch out, he promised. But don't forget, I've somehow got to get another step down the pipeline to the tap at the end of it. In fact, I've got to get right up close to your friend, Mr. Serafimo Spang. I can't do that by just sending up my card. And I'll tell you something else, Felix.
Bond's voice was deliberate.
I've suddenly taken against the brothers Spang. I didn't like those two men in hoods, the way the man hit that fat negro, the boiling mud. I wouldn't have minded so much if he'd just beaten the jockey up, ordinary cops and robbers stuff, but that mud showed a nasty mind. And I took against Pizarro and Bud. I don't know what it is, but I've just taken against all of them.
Bond's voice was apologetic. Thought I ought to warn you.
Okay.
Lighter pushed away his empty plate. I'll be around and try and pick up the bits. And I'll tell Ernie to keep an eye on you. But don't think you can ask for a lawyer or the British consul if you get in bad with the mob. Only law firm out there is called Smith and Wesson.
He banged on the table with his hook.
Better have one less bourbon and branch water. It's desert where you're going. Dry as a bone, hotter than hell this time of year. No rivers, so no branches to get the water out of. You'll be drinking it with soda and then mopping it off your forehead. It'll be 1:20 in the shade out there, only there isn't any shade.
The whiskey came.
I shall miss you out there, Felix, said Bond, glad to get away from his thoughts. Now to teach me the American way of life. And by the way, I thought you did the hell of a fine job of a shy smile. Wish you could come along and tackle Spang Senior with me. Together, I believe we could take him.
Lighter looked affectionately at his friend.
That sort of rough stuff's no good if you're working for Pinkertons, he said. I'm after this guy, too, but I've got to get him legitimate. If I can find out where the remains of the horse are buried, that hoodlum's going to have an ugly time. It's all right for you coming over here and tangling with him and getting away quick back to England. The gang has no idea who you are. From what you tell me, they can never find out. But I've got to live here. If I had a shooting match or anything of that sort with Spang, his pals would get after me, and after my family, and after my friends. And they wouldn't rest until they'd hurt me more than I ever hurt their pal, even if I killed him. It's not so funny to come home and find your sister's house burned down with her inside it. And I'm afraid that could still happen in this country today. The gangs didn't go out with Capone. Look at Murderink. Look at the Kafova report.
Now the hoodlums don't run liquor. They run governments, state governments like Nevada. Articles get written about it, and books, and speeches, sermons, but what the hell? Lighter laughed abruptly. Maybe you can strike a blow for freedom, home, and beauty with that old rusty equalizer of yours. Is it still the Beretta?
Yes, said Bond.
Still the Beretta.
You still got that 00 number that means you're allowed to kill?
Yes, said Bond dryly. I have.
Well, then, said Lighter, getting up, let's go home to bed and give your shooting eye a rest. My guess is you're going to need it.
Chapter 15. Rue de la Paix. The plane made a big curve out over the sparkling blue Pacific, and then swept round across Hollywood and gained height so as to make the Cajon Pass through the great golden cliff of the High Sierras. Bond caught a glimpse of endless miles of palm-lined avenues, of sprinklers whirling over emerald lawns in front of gracious homes, of sprawling aircraft factories, of the outside lots of film studios with a jumble of gimcrack sets, city streets, western ranches, what looked like a miniature motor racing track, a full-sized four-master schooner planted in the ground, and then they were in the mountains and through them and over the interminable red desert that is the backstage of Los Angeles. They flew over Barstow, the junction from which the single track of the Santa Fe strides off into the desert on its long run across the Colorado Plateau, skirting on their right the Calico Mountains, once the borax center of the world, and leaving far away to the left the bone-strewn wastes of Death Valley. Then came more mountains, streaked with red, like gums bleeding over rotten teeth, and then a glimpse of green in the midst of the blasted Martian landscape, and then a slow descent, and please fasten your seatbelts and extinguish your cigarettes. The heat hit Bond's face like a fist, and he had begun to sweat in the 50 yards between his cool plane and the blessed relief of the air-conditioned terminal building. The glass doors, operated by seeing-eye photoelectric cells, hissed open as he approached and slowly closed behind him, and already the slot machines, four banks of them, were right in his path. It was natural to bring out the small change and jerk the handles and watch the lemons and the oranges and the cherries and the bell fruit swirl round in their final click, pause, ting, followed by a soft, mechanical sigh. 5 cents, 10 cents, a quarter. Bond gave them all a try, and only once, two cherries and a bell fruit coughed back 3 coins for the one he had played. As he moved away, waiting for the baggage of the half-dozen passengers to appear on the ramp near the exit, his eyes caught a notice over a big machine that might have been for iced water. It said, "Oxygen bar." He strolled over to it and read the rest. "Breathe pure oxygen," it said, "healthful and harmless, for a quick lift, eases distress of overindulgence, drowsiness, fatigue, nervousness, and many other symptoms." Bond obediently put a quarter into the slot and bent over so that his nose and mouth were enclosed in a wide black rubber mouthpiece. He pressed a button and, as instructed, breathed in and out slowly for a full minute. It was just like breathing very cold air. No taste, no smell. At the end of the minute, there was a click from the machine and Bond straightened himself. He felt nothing but a slight dizziness. But later he recognized that there had been carelessness in the ironical grin he gave to a man with a leather shaving kit under his arm who had been standing watching him. The man smiled briefly back and turned away. The loudspeaker asked passengers to collect their luggage, and Bond picked up his case and pushed through the swing doors of the exit into the red-hot arms of noon. "You for the tiara?" said a voice. A chunky man with large, very direct brown eyes under a chauffeur's peaked cap shot the question at him from a wide mouth from which a wooden toothpick jutted. "Yes." "Okay, let's go." The man didn't offer to carry Bond's suitcase for him. Bond followed him over to a smart-looking Chevrolet with a lucky raccoon tail tied to its chrome naked lady mascot. He threw his suitcase into the back and climbed in after it. The car moved off and out of the airport onto the parkway. It crossed into the far lane and turned left. Other cars hissed by. Bond's driver kept the inside lane, driving slowly. Bond felt himself being examined in the driving mirror. He looked up at the driver's identification tag. It said, "Ernest Cureo, number 2584. And there was a photograph whose eyes also looked levelly at Bond. End of side 7.